What if they'd called his bluff?
Katura's throat worked.
He wasn't bluffing, he said softly. Fortunately, the pirates realized he wasn't bluffing, so they let him transfer to Banshee with his wife and the girls. It's slower than anything Swenson has, so it can't run away, and Swenson insists it stay within a 250,000 kilometers of his flagship where it's under his guns. I know Captain Ramos, Banshee's skipper, and he won't try anything stupid.
That's certainly hope not, Dorval said.
So officially, I'm here to arrange the missile release and authorization for the Jerye yards to install them, Katura concluded. But my real message was the one I delivered first to Mr. Weissman, and now to you.
I'm sure the consortium was thrilled, Charnay said sourly. And I'm willing to bet Danek will be even more thrilled when they find out a pair of pirate battle cruisers are on the way. How much time do we have, Admiral?
Therein lies the problem, Dorval said heavily. Baird's original plan was to stall the pirates' departure from Walther long enough to give Captain Katura plenty of time to reach Haven, and for us to gather up a proper welcoming committee to send to Danek with Pacemaker. Unfortunately, Swenson isn't the patient type, and refused to give Katura any more time than absolutely necessary.
They didn't want to give him any extra time, but Master Baird convinced them it would take at least 24 hours to process the release here in Nouveau Paris, Katura put in. And they don't know how fast Pacemaker really is.
Luckily, he was able to shave almost 48 hours off his projected transit by bullying his way through the gamma bands, Dorval said. Bottom line, the pirates are due to arrive in 11 T-days, and it's 7 from here to Danek.
Leaving you 4 days to put together a response, Lisa murmured, wincing.
That is, unfortunately, the relative math, the Admiral said. What is worse than that, Santange and her escorts are really the only battlecruiser group we know we can get to Danek in time.
Lisa sent a startled look at Marcello.
I thought, she broke off.
You thought we had the biggest navy in the sector, Charnay said.
His voice was odd, his eyes gazing out at nothing.
But we also have a lot of associated systems who look to us for collective security. Aside from the capital squadron,
which we can't touch, Dorval put in.
Which I wouldn't touch even if I could, Charnay agreed. Especially with a major pirate force in the neighborhood. The majority of our strength is in battlecruiser groups covering all those other star systems. Admiral, are Artois and Provence still in the yards?
Yes, Dorval said. And Poitou is down with a bad alpha node. We can hope the pirates aren't as skilled or well-armed as we are, but that's just an assumption. The numbers themselves certainly aren't promising.
I've brought along Captain Ramos's best estimates on their ship types and acceleration profiles, Katura offered.
Everyone turned to look at him.
Excuse me? Dorval asked.
Ramos served in the Salarian Navy for 23 T-years before Master Robotham hired him, Katura explained. He knows his warships, and he had plenty of time to work his passive sensors. He couldn't guarantee his acceleration numbers, but he's confident about his class identifications and armaments.
Well, that will definitely help, Charnay observed. Not as much as another battlecruiser or two, but right now we'll take everything we can get.
Beside Lisa, Marcello stirred.
Commodore Charnay, Admiral Dorval? A private word, if I may.
Some of the other Havenite officers frowned, but Dorval took it in stride.
Certainly, he said. This way.
The Admiral led the way into a small office just off the briefing room. Marcello started to step inside, then paused at the doorway.
By the way, Captain Katura, would you happen to have any recordings of Swenson or any of the other pirates?
No, Katura said, his lips compressing briefly with memory. The first thing they did after they captured us was to go into both ships' computers and erase all the comm logs and everything else pertaining to them.
Of course they did, Marcello said.
Thank you.
He continued into the office with the others, closing the door behind him.
I know what you're going to say, Captain, Dorval said before Marcello could speak. And while I appreciate the offer, I'm afraid I can't allow Damocles to assist.
That's indeed a question I'll be addressing in a moment, sir, Marcello said. But I first wanted to raise the possibility that this might be some kind of elaborate ruse.
To what end? Dorval asked.
Possibly to pull your ships out of position, Marcello replied. As you said, you're stretched thin. They may be hoping you'll uncover Nouveau Paris itself in order to respond to Danic. You said you wouldn't touch your capital squadron, but Swenson may not know that. For that matter, they may expect you to bend the rules with an innocent family's life on the line.
I don't like thinking about that, Dorval said grimly. But that decision's not negotiable.
Of course not, Marcello said. Again, Swenson might not realize that.
Or the target could be Santange herself, Lisa added. If they know you won't touch the capital squadron, and also know about the rest of your deployments, they may figure that a single battlecruiser group is all you'll be able to spare.
And we only have Keturah's word regarding the enemy's numbers, Marcello said, nodding. I'm not necessarily saying he's lying, but he could have been deliberately misled. If you go in expecting 8 ships and find yourself facing 12 or 16, even the Republic's edge in weapons and training might not be enough.
Or worse, Lisa added. What kind of gang has the resources to buy and operate a pair of battlecruisers, or needs ships that heavy, for that matter? Frankly, everything Keturah has said sounds to me more like mercenaries than pirates.
Possibly connected to your friend, Tamerlane? Dorval suggested. I'm sure that thought has occurred to all of us, Marcello said. That's why I hoped some of Pacemaker's recordings were intact. My point is that if Swenson is Tamerlane, and if the group is bigger than we know, this could be one of several coordinated attacks on specific Havenite targets.
I suppose that's possible, Dorval said, his forehead furrowed with thought.
But highly unlikely. A group that big would need a huge local logistics support structure, and I can't see that hiding anywhere nearby. Not with Brigadier Massengill poking sticks into all the likely termite hills. And there are ways a pirate gang could have picked up a pair of battlecruisers, Charnay said. That's exactly what the group at Secor was trying to do, remember?
Point, Marcello agreed.
And actually, I doubt anyone would actually try a scheme like I described. But I wanted to make sure the possibility had been raised. But you still think Swenson is connected to Tamerlane? Dorval asked.
I think it possible, Marcello said. And if that's the case, I respectfully submit that under our existing treaty, Damocles has not only a right but also a duty to be involved.
Dorval gave out a low whistle. And with that, the can of worms is officially open, he said. You realize, I presume, that not only would the CNO have to sign off on that, but legal affairs would also have to get involved, not to mention the State Department. I'm not at all sure that 4 days is enough time to sort through all of that.
I realize that, sir, Marcello replied. Nevertheless, I stand by my request.
Dorval looked at Charnay. The Navy's got a long tradition of giving the commander on the scene wide latitude in carrying out his orders, Commodore, he said. Right now it looks like you're going to be that commander. Thoughts?
I agree CNO would have to be aboard, sir, Charnay said. If nothing else, so that he could lean on legal and state. I guarantee they're not going to be happy at the image of a Manticoran warship getting shot up under Havenite command.
He looked at Marcello and Lisa.
On the other hand, Captain Marcello makes a valid point about the moral imperatives here. We've also worked well with Manticore in the past, not just at Secor, but also in our joint pirate hunt program. Their people and capabilities are well known to both our line personnel and command. He smiled tightly. As a purely practical matter, I'll remind the Admiral that Damocles was a major contributor to one of the RMN's 3 enemy kills at the Battle of Manticore. I think I could find a use for an extra destroyer.
Very well, Dorval said. I'll run it up the flagpole and see if anyone wants to take pot shots at it. I just wish you didn't have quite as good a point about how useful you could find them. If I could scare up a few more hulls of our own for you, I would.
I know that, sir.
Charnay looked at Marcello and Lisa.
So our roster is Santange, 3 heavy cruisers, 4 destroyers, a frigate, and RMN Damocles. Not the most cheerful of lineups against 2 battlecruisers and 6 heavy cruisers, but I've seen worse. And we'll have 7 days en route to plan.
He looked back at Dorval and stiffened to attention.
Do I have my orders, Admiral Dorval?
You do, Commodore Charnay, Dorval said,
also coming to attention. He didn't look very happy, Lisa thought, but happiness seemed in generally short supply at the moment.
Start your spin-up immediately. Requisition whatever you need. I want you ready to sortie within 36 hours.
We will be, sir.
Good, Dorval said. Good luck.
Thank you, sir,
Charnay said.
And if I may make a suggestion, I recommend that you not mention our discussion about feints and ruses in front of Keturah or Weissman.
In case this is a ruse?
Yes, sir,
Charnay said.
Exactly.
Santange and her escorts were indeed ready to depart within Dorval's window. So was Damocles.
I doubt the Admiralty would be thrilled if they knew what we were up to,
Lisa warned Marcello as they headed for the hyperlimit.
Lucky for us they're not here,
Marcello replied.
Or was that a roundabout way of saying you had your own qualms?
Not qualms, exactly, sir,
Lisa hedged. Marcello wasn't as rigid on quiet criticism as some officers she'd worked with, but that didn't mean she should abuse the privilege.
I'm just a little concerned about the logistics, not to mention this new software.
We can hardly work with Charnay if our computers and sensors can't talk to his,
Marcello pointed out.
And don't forget that even though the Havenite ships are built locally, all of us are basically Salarian designed.
In a way, we were built to interface.
Yes, sir,
Lisa said. And really, their hardware was mostly compatible, though of course the Havenite versions were newer upgrades.
I'm mostly worried about how far they'll be able to get into our systems.
Mostly it'll just be our communications interface,
Marcello said.
I wish we could do more. A fully distributed fire control network, for instance, would be extremely useful.
But our missiles are too old and don't interface with their systems well enough for that.
There's still all the sensor data and comm traffic,
Lisa said.
I'm not worried so much about whether the access filters will work as I am about the access we had to give them. Even with Papadakis's people looking over their shoulders, who's to say they didn't slip in a worm or gather a program?
Hard to see what we could possibly have that they might want,
Marcello said with a hint of dryness.
Anyway, we theoretically ice-walled all of our encryptions and private data and protocols before we let them into the system. If they've got a worm that can tunnel through all that, and there's some reason for them to try it, then yes, we could be in trouble.
Still, encryptions and protocols can be changed, and I imagine the Admiralty will do exactly that as soon as we return.
Yes, sir,
Lisa agreed, her throat unpleasantly dry, when they returned. If they returned. In many ways, this was worse than even the invasion of Manticore. There, they'd had barely hours to realize what was happening, and all of that time had been filled with frantic work as every ship in the Navy scrambled to get combat ready. Here, they were going to have days to handle all that prep work. Days which would give everyone aboard plenty of time to lie in their racks, thinking about what lay ahead. Their training was supposed to have prepared them for this kind of situation. But as Lisa looked back now, she realized it hadn't prepared them nearly well enough. But then, probably no training really could.
So let's forget about potential problems with our allies and focus our attention on the definite problems with our opponents,
Marcello continued.
We have 7 days to make sure everything and everybody is ready for whatever's coming at us. I trust you've made that point to Ravel?
Yes, sir, I have,
Lisa assured him.
Not that she needed the reminder. She's been elbow deep in analysis, simulations, and layered plans since we got the news.
And she was a competent enough TO, Lisa knew. Still, she didn't seem to have that spark of outside-the-box thinking Travis did. She wished Travis was here. Not just because his way of thinking could prove crucial in the battle ahead, but because she missed him.
And we've received Commodore Charnay's proposed drill schedule?
Yes, sir. His operations officer sent it over,
Lisa said again.
Not that I've shared that schedule with anyone yet.
Are you planning to?
Actually, sir, with your permission, of course. No.
Good, Marcello said. Though I trust you realize that if our people flub our very first joint exercise with the rest of the squadron, it's not going to look good.
I discussed that with Commander LaForge, Lisa said.
I told her what I had in mind, and she grabbed it and ran.
She's not going to tell their people the schedule either?
Exactly,
Lisa said.
So if there's any flubbing, it'll probably be pretty broadly shared.
Good enough, Marcello said. Just be aware that if Revel and her people turn in a subpar performance, they'll pay for it in more work and less sleep.
Understood, sir, Lisa said. The last thing we want is to hit Danik without everyone running at peak performance.
Marcello gave a little snort. Remember the old days, Commander? The days when we ran drills and exercises with plenty of advance warning?
You mean the old days a year ago?
Those are the ones.
Lisa nodded. Those had indeed been slower, lazier, more comfortable times. Part of that had been from necessity, as recalcitrant or downright broken ship systems needed to be babied into something approaching readiness. But another part of it had been the old PALS network in action, making sure the officers involved had as much time as possible to bring their departments up to snuff. Career essential efficiency reports had written on how well they performed, after all, and it would never have done to have someone blot his or her copybook simply because they hadn't had a couple of weeks to get ready. But those days were gone forever. The Star Kingdom had been attacked, and the RMN would never again be simply a comfortable place to tread water and drift along until an equally comfortable retirement. When the old days faded, the old habits and systems had to fade with them.
Still, sic transit gloria mundi, as the saying goes, Marcello continued. He raised his eyebrows. You were planning to share the schedule with me, weren't you?
Of course, sir, Lisa said in her most respectfully innocent voice. How could you possibly think otherwise?
You realize, of course, Joshua Miller warned, that on its basic, fundamental level, this document is largely worthless as a lever.
True, Elizabeth conceded. And if he chooses to play it on that level, it will make a messy situation that much worse.
Breakwater won't fight, Michael said from across the table. He understands reality, but he also understands the intangibles of appearance. He'll do what you want, Elizabeth, if only to preserve his reputation for future options.
Elizabeth felt her throat tighten. He'll do what you want. Not what the former king wanted, or what a prominent member of the Commons wanted, or even what all three of them wanted together. What you want. It had been over a year since Elizabeth had been crowned queen. In all that time, there'd been maybe half a dozen brief periods when she'd actually felt like a true sovereign. Now, with that single word, the full impact of her title, position, power, and responsibility suddenly hit her.
I hope you're right, Your Highness, Miller said, inclining his head toward Michael. I suppose only time will tell. He paused. But whatever happens, Your Majesty, he added to Elizabeth, his voice going almost shy, I want to thank you for allowing me to be part of it.
You're quite welcome, Mr. Miller, Elizabeth assured him. For my part, I'll forever be in your debt for the service you've provided to the Crown, to the Star Kingdom, and to me personally.
It was a duty I was more than happy to perform. Miller's shoulder shifted, as if he wanted to reach over and touch her hand.
Not in a forward or inappropriate manner, Elizabeth sensed, but merely a friendly, companion-like touch. But at the last second, he seemed to sense it would be inappropriate or unwelcome. The shoulder shifted back, and his hand remained where it was. And so, since Elizabeth was likewise feeling a sudden yearning for human contact, she took the initiative, reaching over to touch his hand. Miller seemed to stiffen, just slightly. Across the table, Elizabeth sensed her father stir as if about to speak, then go still again. She withdrew her hand.
You'd best go now, she said. We still have a lot of work to do.
Indeed, Your Majesty, Miller said, standing up and bowing to her. Just let me know when you need me.
I'll be ready.
He swiveled around, bowed to Michael.
Your Highness. Mr. Miller, Michael said gravely.
Miller turned and headed across the study toward the door, where Sergeant Adler waited to escort him home. Elizabeth watched his back as he walked. In another time, in another place. She shook the thought away, or rather the thought faded of its own accord. As long as Carmichael's memory danced through her mind and heart and soul, there could never be another man allowed to take the empty place at her side. It was almost funny, in a crudely ironic sort of way, how everyone had thought Burgundy's final data file had been a list of potential suitors. She'd thought that. The Prime Minister's own secretary had apparently thought it, and whoever had leaked the names to Breakwater had clearly thought it. Maybe that list would have come next, had the Prime Minister lived a few more weeks. What everyone had clearly forgotten was that Burgundy was a servant of the Crown as well as a close friend to the Wintons. He'd seen the coming fight over succession as clearly as Breakwater had, and so had left his queen his final legacy. Across the office, Miller and Adler slipped out into the empty corridor, Adler closing the door behind them.
"He's a good man," Michael murmured.
His tone, Elizabeth noted, gave no hint as to which of the two possible implications her father might be going for with the words.
"Yes, he is," Elizabeth agreed. For a moment, she was tempted to tease the double meaning back at him, just for the fun of it. But she was queen, and fun was no longer something she could engage in spontaneously. It was, instead, a precious commodity to be carefully saved for specific times and places. "He'll make a good ally in the Commons."
Again, she sensed her father's shift in posture, though whether in relief or disappointment, she couldn't tell.
"And the others?"
"Jacques Corlane will certainly stand alongside Mr. Miller," Elizabeth said. "Placido Amadeo."
"You really can call him Joshua, you know,"
Michael pointed out gently.
"At least when we're alone. It's quite obvious you like the man."
"Placido Amadeo and his company have a great deal of influence on several of the other MPs," Elizabeth continued doggedly. "I'm confident that he'll also answer Mr. Miller's request to use that pressure when needed. All in all, I think we've got a good chance."
Her father gave a barely audible sigh.
"I agree," he said. "Though if Breakwater doesn't, but of course he will," he corrected himself hastily. "And now I believe it's time to put these old bones to bed. Unless you need me some more tonight."
"I'll always need you, Dad,"
Elizabeth said, reaching across the table and squeezing his hand.
"But for now, pleasant dreams."
"You won't always need me, Elizabeth," Michael said.
He squeezed her hand in turn, then let go and stood up.
"In fact, I'm not sure you need me right now. And I'm glad of that. Very glad."
He smiled.
"But if you don't need me, I hope you'll always want me."
"Always, Dad," Elizabeth said quietly. "Sleep well, and be sure to kiss Mom for me."
"She's probably already asleep."
"Then just kiss her very, very gently."
Chapter 31. Between the time required to chase Haman from Lau Hyler to Zaxxon and the flight time from there back to Walther, 39 T-days would elapse by the time Casey returned to the Volsung's home system. With no idea of the mercenaries' operational patterns, it was impossible to predict whether or not some, or all, of the rest of their vessels would have returned in the cruiser's absence. That thought continued to nag at the back of Travis's mind. Still, Clegg, Basaltberg, and Kane, Zhao, rather, didn't seem particularly concerned about it. They continued to plan and to hold frequent conferences as the Allied force headed back to Walther. Or at least, they weren't showing any particular concern, which was not, of course, the same thing. Still, Travis could sense a certain oddness about the Andermani and their attitude towards Jensen. It was an attitude Chomps had also picked up on, and the two of them discussed it on several occasions over a beer in Travis's quarters. They never found a conclusion to safely land on, but both agreed that Basaltberg was being driven by more than just a desire to deal with a potential threat to their empire's security. Still, if the Andermani were reticent about exactly what Jensen might have done to awaken such ire, they'd been far more forthcoming about their navy and its capabilities than Travis had anticipated. It was eye-opening, and more than a little astonishing. Unexpectedly, at least to Travis, it was also a little humiliating. The Andermani were sharing information and advice so enthusiastically because the Royal Manticoran Navy wasn't remotely in their league. Even Casey, the most modern ship in the RMN, was simply outclassed. In a purely technological sense, Casey was in at least shouting distance of her new consorts. But she was the RMN's outlier, the only ship they had which could make that claim. The Saltberg's ships all mounted equally, uniformly, modern weapon systems and electronics. Yet, in many ways, the Star Kingdom's Navy's technological inferiority might very well be its least glaring weakness. The far more serious detriment was that the RMN lacked the Andermani's institutional knowledge, their infrastructure, their technology, and, most damning of all, their experience. The Andermani hadn't drawn attention to it, of course. They'd accepted Travis and Clegg's proposal for dealing with the mercenary base's missile platforms, and had been highly complimentary about Casey's role in the Battle of Manticore. Yet below the surface, Travis could sense that they also thought the RMN had won that battle as much by sheer luck as by actual military skill. None of them seemed to question the Manticoran's courage and determination, but he'd had the distinct impression that they'd found it hard not to roll their eyes during discussions of both participants' tactics during the battle. As Casey's tactical officer, Travis had been deeply involved in the planning sessions carried out en route back to Walther. Many of those had been calm conferences, but at Basaltberg's insistence, he and Clegg had dined several times on Vergeltung as the Admiral's honored guests. Technically, those dinners had been social occasions, but there'd been quite a bit of professional conversation as well. Somewhere along the way, Travis had realized that Basaltberg, Zhao, and Captain Luitpold Huschens, Vergeltung's captain and Admiral Basaltberg's flag captain, were quietly conducting a seminar for the benefit of the Manticorans. Travis had no problem with that. On the contrary, he had determined to soak up any insight they offered like an eager sponge. It was harder to tell about Clegg, though he noted that when she offered a response or a comment, it was always succinct, to the point, and thoughtful. Clearly, she was as aware as he was of just how much the RMN still had to learn. But she'd also been a king's, and now a queen's, officer a lot longer than Travis had. She'd been one of the people who'd fought for decades to simply keep the Navy alive, having to now face the evidence of what the RMN could have been, and had never been allowed to be, had to be harder on her than it was even on Travis. Vergeltung was a perfect case in point. The battleship was far newer than the RMN's battlecruisers. No one, even in the Salarian League, had been building ships this big when Manticore purchased the Lexington-class battlecruisers nearly a T-century ago. But Travis knew a refitted ship when he saw one. In fact, he suspected that Vergeltung hadn't been refitted so much as rebuilt. There were clear signs of heavy damage, including both external and internal stiffening plates, the kind used to relieve stress on hull frames and decking after significant breakage. After that kind of damage, a hull seldom survived. The repair costs had probably been close to the purchase price of a newer ship of the same class. Gustav Andermann must have wanted her badly to invest that much in putting her back together again. But however old the basic hull was, and however severely it might have been mauled in the past, Travis had no doubt of its soundness and integrity. And there was nothing at all old, obsolete, or worn out about Vergeltung. Her electronics were cutting edge. He hadn't personally examined her missiles, but they were listed as Star Storms, the same round the SLN had used as recently as 12 T-years ago. The fusion boosters that kicked those missiles out of their tubes were at least twice as powerful as those aboard Manticoran ships, allowing the weapons to get safely clear of the wedge and on their way correspondingly faster. Her single spinal laser was a massive weapon, again at least twice as powerful as anything the RMN mounted. She was lavishly equipped with active anti-missile defenses, including heavy autocannon, advanced defensive electronic warfare suites, and a towed decoy system that would make any tactical officer's mouth water. The improvised Allied squadron exercised together a half dozen times during the voyage from Zaxxon back to Walther. And even in the exercises, it had been painfully obvious that Vergeltung's ECM were far more advanced than Casey's, even after her refit, far less the rest of the RMN's units. Basaltberg's other ships presented much the same picture. Though not all of them were new, they'd all been carefully maintained and upgraded on a regular basis by a Navy which understood the advantages of operational homogeneity and believed in keeping its ships ahead of anything they were likely to encounter. Travis could only wish some of the people responsible for Manticoran naval priorities could see what he was seeing, and from Clegg's dark moods after their visits to Vergeltung, he guessed she had the same thoughts. She'd been watching the Navy, her Navy, slowly fall apart, disintegrate into a hollowed-out shell for a lot longer than he had. And now, she was about to take the least hollow ship of that shell into battle. All the way back from Zaxxon, Travis had had the nagging fear that the Andermani might have been putting too much trust in the data he and Chomps had picked up during their flyby of the Volsung's base. Now, sitting in N-space 10 light minutes outside the Walther hyperlimit, on the farthest side of the system from Walther Prime, he found out why Basaltberg hadn't been worried.
"I have got to get me one of those," Chomps muttered as he, Travis, and a dozen other Manticorans gazed at the viewscreen and the vac-suited Andermani techs working on Vergeltung's hull. Travis hadn't gotten a good look at this bit of SMS tech during the trip, and he rather doubted they were going to get one now.
"I wonder how they crammed everything in," Chomps continued, rubbing his chin thoughtfully. "It can't be more than half again the size of a standard shuttle."
Travis nodded. Only a shuttle and a half, and yet somehow the Andermani had crammed in a sensor suite far better than the one Casey's techs had rigged up, and had even had room for a set of impellers. It had to be Salarian tech. Somehow, even way out in the Andermani Empire, Gustav must still have a pipeline back there that enabled him to get hold of this kind of cutting-edge equipment. Did that mean that the Salarians also had these recon drones? Probably. All that mattered at the moment, though, was that Vergeltung had one of them. Such marvels came with a cost, of course. The drone was big enough that the battleship had been required to give up a missile launcher site in order to provide a hull mooring point for it. In the missing tube's place was a housing which, intentionally, no doubt, closely mimicked the weapon mount which had been removed. The housing was more than just camouflage, though, almost certainly providing an atmosphere seal and allowing a shirt-sleeve environment for the drone's maintenance. The drone was too big for the housing to hold it in fully assembled form. Putting the bits and pieces together and testing them had occupied a sizable number of Vergeltung's technicians for the last 7.5 hours. But the suited figures were drifting back towards the battleship now. And then, without fanfare, the drone was away. It was hard to make out, even with the viewscreen set to maximum zoom. Like the modified shuttle Travis and Chomps had ridden, it was painted a black so deep that the light from the Andermani tech's helmet lamps had seemed to simply melt into it. At the moment, its running lights were glowing, but when those winked out, the drone would just disappear. Unless it occluded a star, no optical sensor had a hope of spotting it. According to Commander Anholt, Admiral Basaltberg's operations officer, the drone was capable of a max acceleration of 1,500 gravities, not quite half that of a missile in long-range cruise mode. But unlike a missile, the drone's impellers could be turned off and then on again. That was vital, given the limits of their power supply. Even the Andermani couldn't squeeze a reactor into something that small. The impellers would only be used for relatively brief accelerations and decelerations, with lengthy ballistic phases in between. That made for a prodigious operational range, as well as contributing enormously to its stealthiness along the way. The deeper implications of such a system were enormous, not just for tactical drones or missiles, but also for small craft. Travis's mind flashed back to all the slow shuttle rides he'd taken over his years in the RMN. If those shuttles had been equipped with impellers, he could have saved many dreary hours of his life. In the distance, the drone's lights vanished, probably because they'd been switched off, but equally possibly because when something pulled away at 1,500 gravities, it got itself out of sight in a hurry.
"And they're off," Chomps murmured. "Wonder what it'll find."
"Whatever's there," Travis said. "I wonder if it'll really be able to find its way back home."
"I don't think even a drone would risk pissing off Admiral Riefenstahl by getting lost," Chomps assured him. He shook his head. "But yeah, I really, really want one."
"My congratulations yet again, Captain Marcello," Commodore Charnay said from the comm display, a tight but satisfied smile on his face. "Damocles did you proud, again."
The smile morphed into a grimace. "I wish all of my ships performed that well and that consistently. Entrepide's crew, in particular, needs to work on scrubbing away the rust."
"Thank you, Commodore," Marcello said, fully appreciating the depth of the other's compliment. Entrepide was one of Charnay's modern, powerful destroyers, but her skipper had been taken by surprise by the first of Commander LaForge's drills. Once she'd recovered from the surprise, she'd performed adequately. Just not as well as Damocles. Despite the destroyer's age and the Royal Manticoran Navy's relative inexperience, only three of the Havenite ships had reached full combat readiness before Marcello's crew, even in the first exercise. And his people had performed equally well in all of the subsequent drills the Commodore had laid on, consistently placing in the top five scorers in each exercise. The results had been well worth the time and effort. A T-week of Charnay's and Commander LaForge's drills had turned an already professional group of officers and crews into a group that now operated with a clean, snappy precision Marcello wished the RMN possessed. Not surprising, really. Under normal circumstances, training was just training. But here, every man and woman aboard the Havenite ships was fully aware that the drills would be followed by actual, vicious combat, and that they would be on the short end of the firepower ratio. "Have you decided on the initial deployment yet, sir?" he asked Charnay. The last three or four drills had tested alternative deployment plans, and Marcello knew which one he preferred. But Damocles was the visiting member of the team, and that decision would be the Commodore's alone.
"I have," Charnay said. "Assuming we manage to beat the pirates to Danic, we'll go with Ambuscade. If they get there before us, we'll go to Masquerade and hope we can convince them to leave the system intact."
"Which would mean abandoning Baird and his family," Marcello pointed out.
"I know," Charnay said heavily. "Letting them get away is clearly less than optimal, for other reasons as well. But we don't have the firepower to take them head on. Besides, much as I hate what'll almost certainly happen to the Bairds, I can't possibly justify a fleet battle in the heart of the Danic system if there's any way to avoid it. The collateral damage there could be enormous, even if the mercenaries didn't threaten to deliberately destroy its deep space infrastructure for tactical leverage."
"Understood," Marcello said. Like Charnay, he hoped they wouldn't have to go with Masquerade, even if Damocles' antics during the Barkan incursion into Manticore had served as its inspiration. That had been an interesting set of conversations. Their Havenite hosts had been politely skeptical when he and Lisa described Commander Long's boosted impeller deception, mainly, Marcello suspected, because they'd been astonished anyone had fallen for such an ancient chestnut. But slowly that attitude had changed. It was an ancient trick, but that also meant it was so old a lot of navies had completely forgotten about it. In addition, as Charnay had reminded them, the reason the tactic had once been so common was that until an attacker reached detailed sensor range, he had to assume he truly was looking at the larger and more powerful ships. The consequences if he decided it was a ruse and been wrong would have been disastrous. And so Charnay had dusted the concept off and incorporated it into the Masquerade deployment. If the mercenaries were already inside the inner system when the Allied squadron arrived, his two modern heavy cruisers, Jocelyn Pelion and Jean-Claude Courtois, would run up their impellers to simulate battlecruisers, while Courageux and Intrépide ran theirs up to simulate heavy cruisers. That much apparent firepower should give the pirates pause and add weight to Charnay's demand that they depart Danic space upon pain of attack. It might even work. Hopefully that situation wouldn't arise. If the pirates kept to their timetable, which they had every reason to do, given Baird's insistence that they had to be a scheduled arrival, Charnay's squadron would arrive over a day and a half before they did. In that case, Ambuscade offered a much higher chance of success. There was only one part Marcello considered truly chancy, although he understood why Charnay had included it.
"Is Brigadier Massengill confident her people will be able to get aboard both ships, sir?" he asked. "Brigadier Massengill," Charnay replied with a somewhat lopsided smile, "is confident her people can do anything. And to date, she's always managed to back that up. In this case, I'll admit, I'm a bit more concerned than usual. But given the data Captain Ramos was able to provide on the pirate ships, I'm willing to risk her teams if it means a chance to take one of their damned battlecruisers out of play early. If Admiral Swenson isn't too skittish about splitting his force. And if I were him, I'd be leery about doing that," Charnay agreed.
We just have to convince him that he's expected, and there aren't any unfriendly welcoming committees around. I figure there's maybe a 30% chance he'll bite. If he does, I'm guessing he'll send Loki.
Because that's not his flagship? Marcello suggested.
That, and because the Bayezid-class ships have older compensators. She's slow, so it would make more sense to detach her. Assuming he bites, of course.
Marcello nodded. It would be better for the Havenites if Swenson sent Odin, which was far and away the most powerful of the pirate ships. But Charnay was right. If Swenson detached any of his ships, it would probably be the one most likely to hold down his fleet acceleration rate.
And one bite is all it'll take, Charnay continued. If the Brigadier's people get aboard, any battlecruiser is toast. Even if Swenson has the equivalent of a marine detachment, which they might if they're mercenaries and not pirates, they aren't going to be armored and ready when the commandos come storming in. Personally, if I found myself trapped inside a ship with the 303rd, I'd surrender so fast I'd sprain something. Hopefully they'll feel the same way, Marcello murmured.
Privately, both he and Commander Donnelly had some serious reservations about this part of the plan. Still, if it worked, it would certainly be a masterstroke. And even if Swenson declined to take the bait, it shouldn't leave them worse off than they were already. He felt far more confident about the rest of Ambuscade. It was about as straightforward as a battle plan got, and it should offer them the best tactical situation anyone could hope for. And if Swenson did allow Massengill's commandos to take half his battlecruiser strength off the board, the numerical odds would be the next best thing to even. Having drilled with Charnay's ships for the last 6 days, Marcello liked their chances in that kind of a fight. 10 hours after the drone's departure, Casey once again floated off for Geltung's flank, this time 10 light minutes outside the hyper limit on Walther Prime's side of the system. In the distance, the dim firefly of the decelerating drone approached the hidden fleet. Despite the small size of those impellers, it had required barely 40 minutes and only 41,731,000 kilometers, a little more than 2.3 LM, to attain a velocity of 35,000 kps. It had done that long before it crossed the Walther hyper limit inbound, then coasted ballistically across the entire hypersphere in less than 6 hours before exiting on the far side. It had then re-engaged its impellers and begun braking for recovery by its mothership. Now Travis watched the faint signal of that stealthy impeller wedge come to rest less than 500 kilometers clear of Vergeltung, wondering what its sensors had found. The answer, it turned out, was quite a lot.
I have to say, Admiral, Captain Clegg said to Basaltberg's image on the bridge comm screen in front of her, that your probe has definitely added new meaning to the old adage that bad news travels fast.
It's a concern, certainly, Admiral Basaltberg conceded. We're fortunate it passed close enough for the drone to get a decent look at it.
Have you identified it? Clegg asked. Nothing from our ship archives comes closer than 82% probable.
It appears to be one of the old Beowulfin Stelio-class ships, Basaltberg said. Beowulf retired them decades ago, but obviously there are still some in service elsewhere.
Travis had already keyed his display. The entry came up, and he ran his eyes quickly down the entry. Stelio-class ships ran to about 200,000 tons, and were somewhat more modern than the RMN's Lexington-class battlecruisers. The original weapons systems were listed, but since the Volsungs had probably upgraded it over the years, that information was only marginally relevant. He also noted in passing that that particular class had come in at only 79% probable in their own archive search. Yet another area in which the Andermani were ahead of them.
A significant weapons platform, Basaltberg continued, but not anything Vergeltung can't handle.
No doubt, Clegg replied. Though I'd just as soon not have had this added to the mix at the last minute.
You should learn to look upon the positive, Captain, Major Zhao offered. The more ships which are present, the more ships we can dispose of.
Exactly, Basaltberg agreed. He tapped the plot in front of him. And not just present, but so conveniently gathered together for us.
Travis nodded silent agreement as he shifted his eyes again to the plot on the TAC display.
The Andermani drone had passed close enough to get a detailed look at the group of ships in orbit around Walther Prime in company with the Volsung space station. There were 26 of them in all, three more than Travis and Chomps had observed in their own flight through the system. Two of the newcomers were freighters, which were unlikely to matter as far as the upcoming combat was concerned, bringing the total freighter count to 9. One of those was obviously a tanker, while another, judging from the hab sections, was probably a personnel transport. The rest appeared to be standard freighters, most in the 2 million ton range. Most showed no sign of armament, although it was possible they were more conventional Q-ships than Haman and simply chose to keep their teeth hidden. But that seemed unlikely, and Travis suspected the majority were prizes the mercenaries had acquired. That left 17 warships, 2 light cruisers, 10 destroyers of one sort or another, and 5 Ordra-class Silesian frigates. Plus, of course, the newly arrived Stilio-class battlecruiser. Under the circumstances, Travis thought, one might wonder just how conveniently what had been gathered, and for whom.
Certainly an impressive collection of hulls, the Andermani admiral continued. Commander Anholt's best estimate is that they outmass us by a bit more than 2 to 1, not counting the base missile platforms, now that the Stelios been added to the equation.
Again, Travis nodded silently to himself. That fit his estimate as well.
Of course, if all goes according to plan, the missile platforms will cease to be an issue shortly before a battle is fully joined,
Basaltberg said.
We also estimate that at least 5 of the destroyer-range vessels and 3 of the frigates are down for maintenance. Several appear to be undergoing long-term refits and need not enter into our calculations. The others seem to be undergoing more limited repair, but given the probable efficiency of technicians working for Jensen, I doubt that any of them can be made combat ready in the available window.
Travis and Clegg exchanged looks. Both of them, Travis had no doubt, were remembering another star system and another group of warships trying frantically to clear their maintenance docks.
That leaves only 9 combat-capable mobile units as opposed to our 7, Basaltberg said. And I venture to say that our ships are better armed and equipped than theirs on any ton-for-ton comparison.
His expression hardened.
But there is more to war than tonnage or hardware. There is a vast difference between mercenaries who prey upon the weak and the helpless, and the navy which stands between them and their victims. It is a difference we Andermani understand better than most, perhaps. Firepower and numbers matter, but so does the willingness to stand and fight.
I can't argue with any of that, sir, Clegg said. However, as you say, firepower and numbers are significant factors, and we can only hope there aren't more battlecruisers wandering around the outer system the way this one was.
Basaltberg shook his head. I doubt there will be any more of them.
May I ask why? Because I don't believe this one was wandering the outer system, as you suggest, Basaltberg said.
It seems obvious that we caught her arriving from out-system. Any additional ships would almost certainly have been in company with her and therefore also have been spotted by the drone.
I agree it's likely she was inbound and not just returning from some kind of exercise, Clegg said, frowning. May I ask why you believe it obvious and not simply likely?
Basaltberg gestured to Major Zhao, standing silently at his side. Major, he invited.
Jensen has certain habits, Captain, Zhao explained. Habits to which he insists all of his captains conform. A final loop around a fixed or orbiting base whenever one of his ships arrives on station is one of those habits. That's what this ship was doing.
Really? Clegg peered hard at the plot. What does he hope to accomplish with that kind of maneuver?
A dog circling its bed,
Travis murmured to himself. You have something to add, Tio? Clegg asked.
Sorry, ma'am,
Travis apologized, feeling his face warming.
My mother breeds dogs, and I was remembering that some breeds like to circle their beds before lying down. Goes back to when they slept in the wild and wanted to drive out any snakes or large insects that might be hiding in the grass.
Exactly correct, Commander Long,
Basaltberg said, inclining his head in Travis's direction. An especially impressive feat, given that Travis wasn't within the field of view of Clegg's comm.
Jensen knows how vulnerable orbiting stations are to sneak attacks, so he likes to take occasional looks, hopefully unexpected, behind any blocking planet or moon. An incoming ship, which is already on the move, is ideal for that purpose. That's why, as Major Zhao points out, he has always had standing orders to that effect.
I suppose that makes sense, Clegg said, a bit doubtfully.
It represents a hard-learned lesson of the Imperial Navy, Captain, Saltberg said. Though, had he taken the entire lesson to heart, he would order periodic, erratically scheduled sweeps with the ships already in system.
Or post a unit in a position to watch their backs, Clegg said.
Exactly, Saltberg said. Though, in face of our proposed tactics, any decision on their part to sweep the far side of Prime would have been of no utility. Regardless, I believe the vessel's flight profile positively confirms that she is a recent arrival, not something that your people missed on your probe of the system.
I understand and concur, Clegg said, inclining her head.
Saltberg nodded back. I also point out in passing, Captain, that our drone's information matches almost perfectly with your own sensor records. An impressive feat indeed for an improvised installation. And if it is a recent arrival, Zhao said, his voice going darker, it's possible that Jensen himself may be aboard her. He prefers to be shipboard rather than spend time on a station or on the ground, especially as a ship offers the option of running away if he so chooses.
Exactly, Saltberg said.
I believe we have gleaned all that we can from the drone's data. Instruct all units that we will initiate Operation Verräterweg in 1 hour.
To tomorrow, Jensen said, lifting his glass toward the comm screen.
To tomorrow, Lynn echoed, his image lifting his in turn. It was an odd dinner, Jensen thought, as he set his glass back on his table. Bizarre, even, if one thought too hard about it. He'd originally invited Lynn to Odin for a last meal together before they reached Danik, and Lynn's promised missile upgrade could begin. Part of the invitation had been to see what additional information he might be able to worm out of Lynn on various subjects. Part of it had been to have the option of politely insisting Lynn stay in his sight during the early stages of the operation, just in case. Maybe Lynn had sensed that second part lurking under Jensen's courtesy. Maybe he had preparations of his own to make before Danik and simply didn't want to be away from his ship, even for a couple of hours, this close to the end of their voyage. Or maybe he felt that it was time for him to host one of their infrequent dinners. He'd counteroffered to treat Jensen this time around, an invitation that the Volsung Admiral had likewise found an excuse to decline. And so here the two of them sat, eating in their individual ships, conversing via comm like people in a long-distance relationship. Still, if the second part of Jensen's plan was out, the first was still viable. He'd been watching Lynn's alcohol intake closely, paying particular attention to the minute but clear evidence of impaired motor skills. Now, as the meal drew to a close, was his best chance at persuading the little man to get talkative.
"So tell me, Mr. Lynn," Jensen said as he forked one last bite of steak, "how smoothly do you really think this is going to go?"
That's always hard to predict out here on the frontier, Lynn said with a shrug. He took another sip from his glass and returned it to his table. I don't expect any problems, though. The schedule's a bit tight, but I'm fairly confident Katura will have managed to make it to Nouveau Paris and then back to Danik in time.
If he didn't, then you'll have to hang around outside the hyper limit until he gets back, I'm afraid, Lynn said.
But aside from the boredom factor, that shouldn't be anything to worry about. I doubt they'll be worried if we behave ourselves and the authorization comes through within a day or two. There's always a little slippage in interstellar arrangements.
Jensen nodded. The Axelrod operative had said all the right things about the Volsung's future utility to his employers, and what he'd said made sense. On the other hand, what he'd said before the attack on Manticore had also seemed to make sense. But Lynn was damned straight that the squadron was staying safely outside the limit if the expected invitation hadn't gotten back from Haven. Jensen wasn't making any commitment until he was positive Lynn hadn't arranged something nasty under the table. If he had, then the last thing Jensen would do before escaping back into Hyper would be to send the slippery little bastard straight to hell.
We'll just have to hope any slippage is minimal, he told Lin. I'd feel better if I knew exactly which local politician's palm we had to grease. We will have to grease some politician's palm, right?
I assume so, Lin said. Rather, I'll have to apply the grease.
You won't need to be involved with that part. Unfortunately, those names and faces often change out here. But the message Keturah brings back from the Gerier office in Nouveau Paris will take care of that.
You think we'll only have to pay off one person?
Probably only one politician, Lin said. There might also be a yard foreman or two with their hands out, but that should only be loose change by comparison.
And after that, how long before I get my missiles?
Releasing the missiles shouldn't take long, Lin assured him. Not more than a day or so for the paperwork. As for the systems installation and then the actual loading, you'd have a better idea about that than I would. How long does a weapons upgrade like this usually take?
Depends on how urgently it's pressed and who's doing the work, Jensen replied. In a proper yard accustomed to military work, maybe a couple of weeks. In a civilian yard, it could take a month or longer. I'd feel happier if I knew where Gerier falls on that scale.
No idea, I'm afraid, Lin said. The people who handle Axelrod's hardware could probably give you a decent estimate, but that's not my department.
Right. Your department is hiring mercenaries, Jensen said, watching the little man closely. So what exactly does Axelrod want with Manticore, anyway? Is it something on one of the planets? Some extra rich ores in one of the asteroid belts? It's not the tree cats, is it?
Lin pursed his lips, gazing hard at Jensen. Jensen studied his face, searching for signs of intoxication, wishing mightily that he could smell the other's breath. Well, I don't suppose it will be a secret much longer, Lin said at last with a small shrug. Besides, it will be obvious as soon as you get your next assignment. We want to turn Manticore into a staging area for an attack on the Andromani Empire.
Jensen sat up a bit straighter in his chair. They were going to take down Gustav?
Seriously? Why?
Oh, now that's still a secret, Lin said with a slightly hazy but distinctly smug smile.
Why? Does it bother you?
No. No, exactly the opposite, Jensen assured him. I have a bit of history with Gustav Andermann. I hope you'll allow me to be present at his downfall.
Absolutely, Lin promised. Why do you think we chose you for this job in the first place? So I take it you're fully aboard?
Absolutely, Jensen said, feeling better than he had in days, in years.
Revenge for the embarrassing freak defeat at Manticore and the chance to burn Gustav Andermann down to bedrock? Damned right he was aboard.
What's our timetable?
Patience, Admiral, Lin reproved him mildly. First the missiles, then Manticore, then Andermann.
Yes, the missiles, Jensen said,
forcing his mind away from visions of vengeance against Uncle Gustav.
How exactly do you expect that to work?
I thought we'd already covered that, Lin said, frowning. We go to the designated platforms, probably Bergen 1, since that was their most capable yard as of my last information. Once we arrive...
No, I mean the sequencing, Jensen interrupted. Surely they won't be able to refit all 8 ships at the same time.
Probably not, Lin agreed. It'll also depend on how busy they are when we get there. Hopefully they can do, say, 4 at once. Maybe more, but 4 is a safe guess.
During which time the rest of the ships will just be sitting there?
Or taking a tour of the mining facilities? Or going in for a closer look at the gas giant or the twins? Or buying reactor mass and fresh entertainment ships? Lin frowned again.
Why, are you worried that you'll be bored? I'm concerned about awkward questions from people we haven't bribed, Jensen countered. What's going to keep those people and their questions off our backs?
That's why we sent Keturah ahead, remember? Lin said. All your people have to do is remember they're part of the Imperial Andromani Navy. He wrinkled his nose as he took another sip from his glass. Though I'll admit your ship types are a bit of an odd mix. Still, everybody knows, or assumes, Gustav keeps some non-standard ships tucked away. Plausible deniability, you know, if that becomes necessary.
I imagine Axelrod's also found that approach useful a time or two? Jensen suggested.
Definitely, Lin said, his eyes briefly taking on a faraway look. The point is, nobody is going to question your ID as long as the paperwork from the Home Office says that's who you are. And no one wants to get on Gustav's wrong side without a damned good reason.
I suppose you're right, Jensen said reluctantly.
Of course I'm right, Lin assured him. Oh, and I think I may have forgotten to tell you that they know me here as Max Baird, an agent for a rich Solarian merchant named Robotham. So don't be surprised if you get a call for me by that name.
Understood, Jensen said.
So the slippery little bastard was slippery here as well? Somehow that didn't surprise him.
And now I should go, Lin said, glancing at his chrono. Big day tomorrow, with important screens to make and field. I need to be at my best.
As do we all, Jensen agreed.
It'll be interesting to see how much dock space they have available.
If Captain Keturah performed as well as he always has in the past, that information should be waiting for us when we check in with Danic Traffic Control.
All right, Jensen said. We'll talk again after we translate back to N-Space.
Right. Lin reached toward the comm control, then paused.
By the way, I trust you haven't told anyone else about my connection with Axelrod?
Jensen felt his muscles tense. Which answer was Lin expecting? More importantly, which one should he give him?
Don't be silly, he said. Knowledge is power. Shared knowledge is useless.
He watched Lin's face closely, but there was nothing there but a contented nod.
Good. My employers would be very annoyed with me if they knew our connection had gotten out.
Good night, Admiral. Sleep well.
I will,
Jensen said softly. So he'd given the right answer. Distantly, he wondered what would have happened if he'd given the wrong one.
You too.
Chapter 32. Travis Long felt very, very lonely as he sat at his station on Casey's Bridge. They were 31 light minutes from the Walther system's fiery central furnace. 9 hours ago, the entire Andromani squadron had accelerated away, their impeller signatures disappearing from Casey's sensors an hour after their departure, leaving Casey all alone. He thought back to where this had started, back when he'd suggested that Clegg try to link up with the man they knew then as Captain Kane. Never would he have guessed that this was where it would all end. What surprised him most was how much he'd grown to like and respect these people. True, the Andromani could be a little stuffy, and there was that subtle but ever-present sense that they thought the Manticorans still had a lot to learn. But they'd been more than generous about teaching some of those lessons, and in many ways they'd treated Casey's officers like the equals they definitely weren't. And they hadn't had to agree to Captain Clegg's request to leave